profit and publishing, two words that have an increasingly antagonistic relationship. But Red Hen Press, based in Pasadena, California, has made a virtue of being a not-for-profit. Founded in 1994 to publish and promote literary works often overlooked by the mainstream, Red Hen Press has built its catalog and balanced its checking account by becoming a virtual hub of the Los Angeles area literary community. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance and its podcast series, Beyond the Book. With 250 titles published to date, Red Hen Press can claim a Guggenheim Fellow and a Whiting Award winner among its authors, as well as relationships with urban school districts and numerous reading series held across Southern California and in New York City. Joining me, Christopher Keneally, with her tale of why small matters is Red Hen Press, co-founder Kate Gale. Kate, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us today. We'll tell everybody that you're the author of 5 books of poetry and 6 librettos. In addition to your work at Red Hen Press, you are managing editor of the Los Angeles Review and president of the American Composers Forum, which reminds me of a line my mother used to say. She said, if you want to get something done, go find a busy person. And clearly, Kate, you've been pretty busy over these last few years. We've brought you on the show to talk about Red Hen Press, but also to take a look at this model that you've put together, the nonprofit literary press, and examine it in the light of what's going on in publishing today. So tell us, you're now 17, 18 years in. What's it take to survive?
Well, I would say that, you know, when we began Red Hen Press in 94, the publishing companies that I most wanted to, let's say, be when I grew up were Copper Canyon, Grey Wolf, and New Directions.
That's a pretty ambitious list, obviously.
That was ambitious. Interestingly, if you look at the say, 15 biggest indie presses in the country at this point, almost all of them were founded in the 70s, with the exception of Saraband and Red Hen. Saraband started the same year we did, and they are in Louisville, Kentucky. And so the big challenge for us became that, first of all, those presses that started in the 70s, you know, had access to the big NEA grants of the early 80s that really helped them, their multi-year grants, their advancement grants that really helped them. And those grants are not available anymore. So the kind of funding that was available for Grey Wolf and Copper Canyon and those presses is just not around. So we had that to contend with. And then, you know, if you look at what Saraband has been able to do, they are, first of all, in a very inexpensive city to live in, LA and New York being two of the most expensive cities. And so we have to have a great deal more funding just for payroll. So we had these challenges. And then the other problem with being in a sprawl city like Los Angeles, which really has no literary soul at the heart of it, maybe it has a movie soul, was that, you know, it seems as though almost nothing that you do will make much of a dent in those 10 million people sprawled out like that. And so we actually worked at a different model than what some of these other presses had done. We decided to sort of invent our own method of guerrilla publishing, and that involved community building. And so hence we've got the 4 reading series in LA and 4 in New York. We have our Writing in the Schools program, which is an extensive part of what we do. Chris Abani has talked in that, Doug Kearney. And we also have the Los Angeles Review that we publish twice a year. We have 5,000 we give out in awards a year. So we built a number of other programs into the publishing model beyond simply the publishing of 20 books a year, which would help us to build community, to have more people know about what we do, and to have a sense of some partnership. partnerships.
Well, Kate, if I can ask you about all of that, because it seems like a pretty neat way of going about it. And the notion of community is one that's very much in the ether today around social media. But you were thinking about community long before anyone had heard of Twitter or Facebook back in the early 90s. And yet what that model provided you was, I would assume, an audience for the books as well as a source of contributors.
Absolutely. Because when, you know, the community sees that you're doing something for them, then you've increased the chances that the community will give back to you. And so that becomes a reciprocal situation. So Red Hen would not be in Pasadena here in 3,200 square feet if it weren't for the fact that, you know, that the Pasadena community has been particularly of us. But actually what happened in terms of that community building is that we became quite well known nationwide. Again, we have four reading series in New York. Most of our biggest contributions at this time in Red Hen are from outside Los Angeles itself.
So I mean, again, I think that's interesting. You established, if you will, a satellite presence in Manhattan then to get you on the map there. You didn't need an office, but you needed some kind of a presence. And so you partnered with various organizations to conduct these reading series. And looking at it here, it's the Bowery Poetry Club, Poets House, Cornelia Street Cafe, and KGB Bar. So all of those places allowed you to have a place in Manhattan and a stake in the community there.
Absolutely. So that, you know, you do want the New York publishing world to know who you are and know that something is going on the other side of the Hudson River. The way to do that, as far as I was concerned, was to have an actual presence there.
Well, tell us about the nonprofit challenge, or the challenge for a nonprofit. Of course, being a nonprofit doesn't mean you don't make money. You have to make enough of money. You're just not doing it for profit alone. Fundraising must be a part of that, grant writing and so forth. That itself is its own challenge. Tell us.
Well, let me say, if you were going to divide nonprofits into just two models, there would be a lot of different ways you could divide them. But let's say you were going to divide them in two. One would be the kind of nonprofit that Oxfam is. I'm assuming we're all familiar with Oxfam, but they take in revenue and then give out that revenue for a particular purpose, obviously working on world hunger. And so if Oxfam is selling anything, a T-shirt or something like that, it's essentially a memory item. You're hoping somebody wears that T-shirt or the hat or uses that mug, and other people think well of Oxfam. What we are is the kind of nonprofit that has a significant earned revenue stream. So the other kind of nonprofit would be a publishing company, a theater, an orchestra, an opera. And so there is that earned revenue stream that you're working on very hard. And in the case of Red Hen, about 50% of our revenue is earned in some way, either through award fees or book sales. And then we have donations, and then we have foundations. And in many ways, in terms of the foundation grants, a lot of that is really what I consider contract work, because the foundations are mostly funding our Writing in the Schools project. So that does help the entire organization and certainly enables us, you know, people like Brendan Constantine and Eric Morago, who are writers in Los Angeles, are deriving some of their revenue from doing that Writing in the Schools project. And it's our mission is involved with literature and literacy. And so it's working toward that mission. So in terms of fundraising, what we have is a very active program for writing grants and for soliciting donations from donors. And then, of course, we have a very, very active program for marketing and publicizing our books, because that earned revenue stream is just as important, as far as we're concerned, as bringing in donations.
Well, we're talking right now with Kate Gale, who's the co-founder of Red Hen Press in Pasadena, California, and managing editor of the Los Angeles Review, about this nonprofit model in the publishing marketplace. And I want to ask you about that balance, or that share of the business that is the revenue side and then the grant making and the fundraising side. You said it's about 50-50 right now. Has it always been that way? And can you tell somebody who might be thinking about doing this what the mix seems, you know, right to you?
Well, no, in the beginning, the book sales were much lower. So really what makes the revenue from book sales go up, I would say, would be three things. One, adequate marketing and publicity of the books you have to do until we're way into this. And that goes along with the idea of trying not publish authors who aren't willing to do anything to promote their book. No matter how good their book is, it's just like bringing a child into the world that nobody's going to want to raise. There's no point. So we've tried to be pickier with our authors that we're going to take on to make sure that they're willing to promote the book and obviously do a better job with marketing and publicity. And then we work at being more involved with getting the books out to bookstores. Now that we're distributed by the University of Chicago, that's become quite a bit easier. Tell me your question one more time, though.
I was asking about the balance, and so what you're saying is, I mean, you started from a kind of 90-10 balance between 90% revenue, 90% grants and non-revenue, and then the 10% is, you know, sort of direct sales, and now you've moved to 50-50. Is that about your desired sweet spot?
Well, yes. And the other thing I forgot to say was there's the backlist issue. We publish a book by Ron Carlson this year, and that's certainly a great frontlist book in terms of pushing sales forward. But when you have a solid backlist, that helps because those books, like David Mason's book, Ludlow, continues to sell. Sometimes as many, we got an order when you're at AWP for 2,000 copies of that, and that's a book that's been out for years. So it helps to have a significant backlist. It helps to have some big frontlist, and then it helps to know what you're doing with marketing and publicity. So when you first start, you have no backlist. You don't, often you don't know what you're doing in terms of marketing and publicity. Which sort of leads me to a small segue that when the press was started, I had met this guy, Mark Cull, in a writing group, and I had already gotten a little press started and wanted someone to work with me who could do book designs. And I felt sure that I would be a really good editor. It's good to be overconfident. And I also felt sure in my late, mid-20s when I moved to Los Angeles that I could change Los Angeles to being a literary city. In fact, I felt like I was just the woman to do it. Everything I owned fit in a tiny car, and I was a graduate student, so clearly overconfidence. But my friend Mark wanted to work on designing books, and I figured that was really all we needed. And if I were giving someone advice now who were thinking of starting a press, I would say that other third person that's interested in sales, marketing, maybe finance, maybe keeping the books, that person with a little math accounting background, that person would be nice to have too.
So you need more recently, than two English majors to get this going.
Exactly. Recently, someone said to me, what does Red Hen's business plan look like? And I just kind of blinked a few times because I didn't know what he was talking about.
Right. Well, how does this look moving in towards the future? I mean, the book publishing business, as I mentioned at the beginning, is definitely facing a dynamic period. Who knows what the future is going to look like? But moving forward with the digital revolution underway and with so much changing in the bookstore side of things, how does it look for you 5 years from now? Do you think you need to grow a certain amount to really survive? What are the kinds of things you're doing to prepare for the future?
Well, in our case, we are not prepared. We have a strategic plan that we're in the middle of that I think we've got another 4 years of. And in our current strategic plan, we are not planning to publish more books. Although, let me say that we turn down hundreds of very good titles every year, titles that I really wish we could have published. But we don't have a plan involved involving publishing more titles because
you, you
I
mean more
I
than the more than the ones you already do. So you publish about 20 a year, as I recall.
20 a year. We have no plans to increase that, and that's because I don't see fundraising getting any easier. What we do have plans for is doing more and more ebooks, and in other words, all of our books now all our prose titles, I should say, are available as ebooks, and I see us as having an increasing market and for ebooks and selling more of those. I also think that we will do more anthologies because anthologies seem to be still very interesting to people, and I see us using the internet, viral marketing, social media to do more and more of our publicity. So I think publicity will change. There will be more ebooks, but I don't see necessarily that there's going to be more funding for literature that would enable us to publish more books.
Well, so being conservative at the moment sounds like a reasonable plan. You want to survive into that future rather than sort of burn yourself out. Yeah. Well, obviously you can't plan for the big smash hit, but I was thinking about small presses, and certainly the one that's made the biggest bang in recent times is Akashic with their book, which we can't say the title of on the air, The Children's book called Go the F to Sleep. And I wonder whether you sort of ever dream about getting a big hit like that, that would really sort of be the, the goose that laid the golden egg.
Absolutely. I would love to have what we call in the fundraising business, the Girl Scout cookie problem, which is essentially you're a nonprofit with a product that's so saleable and so popular that you can barely keep up with the grant side because your earned revenue is so high. I would love to have that problem. I'd love to have a bread and butter book that we published that brought in enough revenue that we, first of all, we're sustainable when it comes to our print budget. I mean, the two biggest budget items for a publishing company like ours in Los Angeles are payroll and print. And I'd love to not be worrying about those on a quarterly basis. I'd love to have some cushion there and be working toward both permanent space here in Pasadena and working toward an endowment. Both of those, I feel, would make us function much more comfortably, and that in sustainable model that you're not worrying about the day-to-day in terms of fundraising quite as much, but you can start looking at the bigger picture.
Right. Well, something to dream about and to shoot for. And finally, I mean, with all the work that you do, you are a writer after all yourself. As we mentioned, you've written a number of books of poetry and librettos for 6 operas. Do you still find time to sit at the desk and do your own work?
Yes, I do, but I find that it's much harder to do that when I'm at home. Let's just the press was actually functioned out of our actual house for the first few years, and then there was a 4-year period when there was a building attached to our house that the press was in. And so it was basically on the home grounds for until January of 2009. And so, you know, my kids grew up having to help out with the press and so on. And when it moved out, I thought it'd be much easier to write at home. But unfortunately, my laptop, which I have at home, has all the press files on it. And I have the press in my head all the time. And so really, the time that I end up writing successfully is when I actually get away, which isn't as often as I would like.
Right. Well, we all face that problem these days with the gadgets that follow us around every hour of the day. So we hope sometime you get a chance to turn it off and get some writing done. Kate Gale, co-founder of Red Hen Press, joined us today on the line from Pasadena, California. Her office is there. And thank you so much for being on the program today.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Enjoyed chatting with you. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.